Good afternoon. Welcome to the U.S. Court of Appeals. I'm honored to sit this week, today through Wednesday, with Judge Englehart, Judge Douglas. We've only got two on the docket today. So we'll go ahead and get started and call 25-50855. So many appellants. Bozorgi versus Cassava Sciences. Mr. Costa, welcome to the Fifth Circuit.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Greg Costa for the appellants. The District Court certification order turned the basic presumption into a virtual guarantee of certification. It missed the forest of market efficiency for the trees of judge-made factors. And in applying those judge-made factors, the Court engaged in a rote checklist analysis rather than the rigorous inquiry Rule 23 requires. Had the court engaged in the rigorous analysis the court's precedent requires, it would have revealed that the following astonishing facts doom certification. The stock rose 1,800% during a seven-month period in 2021, eclipsed only by GameStop and AMC, the paradigmatic meme stocks. They made a movie about one of those, and it did that without any relevant news. During the class period, the stock turned over at a weekly rate of 49%, which is what a typical stock does in an entire year. And in terms of short selling, 93% of the short stock available was already used up, which closed off a critical vehicle for incorporating negative information into the stock price. This wasn't an efficient market for cassava stock. It was a feeding frenzy. And these dynamics mean that individual issues of reliance and damages would overwhelm any common ones.
What is the legal definition of market efficiency in this circuit, and where can we find that?
I think the two leading cases are Judge Jones's opinion in Unger and Judge Smith's opinion as well in the Ball case, and it is a market that incorporates new information efficiently, rapidly, typically within a matter of minutes or hours, which was not happening at all here. And then you can also, of course, look to the Supreme Court's guidance in Halliburton and Basic. And here, there's two sides to that coin. I'd also look at the district court opinion in Krogman, which led to these factors. It's the case they love. And Krogman, Judge Lynn up in Dallas, explains that there's two parts of this. One, when there's news, a stock should move. Two, when there's no news, a stock should be stable. And the opposite was happening on both of those counts here. Just to talk about the disconnect between price and news, 11 of the 17 corrective disclosures, that is when the plaintiffs say that the truth finally came out, 11 of the 17 disclosures of this new information didn't move the stock price at all. So most of the news wasn't moving the stock. Then on the other hand, I already mentioned the 1,800% run-up without news. You had from May 13 of 21, a two-month period where the stock price tripled again without any news. And even according to the price movements that their own expert, Dr. Feinstein, looked at, price was movement was just as often happening when there was active social media attention on the stock as there was when there was news. So a total disconnect between the critical definitional feature of market efficiency, which is that news should impact the stock. I do want to step back before I get more into the merits and respond to their mootness argument, which they're using to try and avoid any scrutiny of this problematic certification order. We filed a 28J last week about developments in the district court. So in June, the plaintiffs filed a motion for preliminary approval, and that includes a settlement agreement signed by two of the four defendants, only two of them. But even as to those two, Section 9.16 of that settlement recognizes that this appeal can go forward. Then we have Judge Ezra, just 10 days ago, held a hearing, issued an order, and he said, I'm not even going to rule on the motion for preliminary approval yet, because I want to hear what the Fifth Circuit says. the more efficient course is to hear what the Fifth Circuit says on this appeal of certification. And so there's no mootness. Rule 23 tells us that. 23E has a number of procedures before you can have the settlement of a class action. There needs to be notice sent to all class members. There, of course, has to be the preliminary approval signed by the judge. There has to be an objection period. There has to be a final fairness hearing. None of those cumbersome procedures have happened, and Judge Ezra has now said they're not going to happen until this court decides this appeal, because if this class was not properly certified, there can be no settlement. And the Supreme Court in Amchem makes that crystal clear.
If we agree that the district court failed to weigh the market efficiency evidence, and we vacate on that basis alone, why isn't that the end of the appeal? What do you gain from a reversal on damages that a remand on market efficiency wouldn't already give you?
Well, if the court agrees, as we think the evidence overwhelmingly shows, that this was not an efficient market, it could end there because that defeats predominance. That would be true of a settlement class or a litigation class. And then the case would have to go back. There can obviously be no settlement if there is no properly certified class. And this case would have to be litigated on an individual basis by the parties. So the damages is an independent reason. We think they're both sufficient and both strong bases for reversal. But if the court were to decide on efficiency, then I don't think it needs to decide on damages. And I would just point to the Deepwater Horizon case. I know there's a lot of those. It's a 2014 decision, 739 F3rd 790. And it makes clear that even when a case is settled, a class has to meet the predominance requirement. And that's viewed without regard for the settlement. You're still looking at it like it's being a litigated case. And it's relying on Amchem because the Supreme Court said the same thing there. I mean, in thinking about the settlement, I'll analogize to something the court may be familiar with, which is a conditional guilty plea in a criminal case, which is, you know, a defendant's house is searched, there's drugs everywhere, he tries to suppress the evidence, he loses in district court, he realizes he has no chance at trial, he pleads guilty but keeps the right to appeal that suppression. And then if this court were to reverse on suppression, he'd be back where he started, able to fight the case in district court. If this court affirms the suppression ruling, his guilty plea would stick. It's really the same with this settlement here, because Rule 23 and the agreement itself recognize that you need a certified class before you can have a settlement. So I do want to talk about why the settlement shouldn't stand, because this is not a case that is appropriate for class treatment. We have a number of reasons in our brief, but I want to focus on the two Judge Willett mentioned, which is the lack of an efficient market and then the damages issue. On efficient market, I've already talked about the price disconnect, the complete disconnect between news and price. Another issue is volume. And I would point to Judge McFadden's opinion in the Bed Bath & Beyond case, which is another recognized meme stock. And what Judge McFadden said is he didn't just do a checklist approach to these factors. He paid attention to the individual economic market dynamics. And he said, look, I recognize that normally active trading helps efficiency because that's a vehicle for news to get incorporated into the stock. But here it was hyperactive. The trading was bonkers in Bed Bath & Beyond. And it was here too, based on those statistics I recited. So that factor is actually scrambled. And the crazy levels, the crazy volume of trading disconnected from news tells you something was not functioning here like an efficient market.
Volatility isn't per se inconsistent with efficiency, is it?
I agree with that, Your Honor. If it matches volatile news, is consistent with efficiency. Here the problem is not volatility in and of itself. It's that the volatility was not tied to news. So I'll give you an example. AI stocks are quite volatile right now. And I don't think that's an indication that there's an inefficient market because the news about AI is volatile, right? Every day you can read news about these particular AI companies, the AI market generally. So with all that news, you're going to see a lot of volatile trading. The problem here is you have this extreme volatility rising 1,800% in a 7-month period without news. Their expert concedes there was not news during this extreme movement. So
did your expert ever identify this as meme stock?
Dr. Stoltz, our expert, did not affirmatively opine. He wasn't comfortable saying it was a meme stock. There is no formal legal definition. There's no formal economic definition. But his report is filled with explaining why the dynamics of the stock functioned like a meme stock, like an inefficient market. And that substance is what matters, not labels. But to the extent labels matter, I would point to the fact that there was robust media coverage calling Cassava a meme stock. That was Bloomberg, Business Insider, the Financial Times. Analysts called it a meme stock. In fact, all but two analysts ended up not giving price recommendations. They threw up their hands because it was acting in such a crazy manner. Second, Wall Street Bets, which is a subreddit forum. It was the epicenter of meme stock activity, and Cassava was one of the most frequently mentioned stocks on Wall Street Bets. That's at 6452 of the record. And then there's a Roundhill meme stock index that also listed Cassava. So there's overwhelming evidence that it was considered a meme stock, but what matters again is the actual market dynamics. And I think in addition to the statistics I mentioned, maybe the most powerful evidence that this was a meme stock, that it was inefficient, is the timeline. Okay, January 28th of 2021, brokers stopped trading in GameStop and AMC because those stocks were going berserk, so they halted trading. Less than a week later, there are over 1,600 mentions a day of Cassava on Wall Street Bets and on Twitter. That's at 6453 of the record. And in fact, on February 3rd, there were 54 million shares of Cassava traded in a single day. There's only 40 million shares outstanding. And then you had this seven-month meteoric 1,800% rise.
And Judge Ezra never made any kind of findings on the meme stock premise because he viewed it as legally irrelevant?
Correct. The opinion says it's basically off limits because the Fifth Circuit hasn't opined on meme stocks. Well, that's because no circuit has opined on meme stocks. It's a relatively recent development. We do have Judge McFadden's Bed Bath & Beyond decision out of D.C. that I think is an example of how a court needs to grapple with the economics and the actual market dynamics. And that's consistent with Unger, Judge Jones's opinion that I referenced earlier, where she says, these aren't a checklist, a rote exercise. You have to actually analyze the economics. And if the economics had been analyzed, the court would have seen this complete disconnect between news and price. It would have seen that the ability to short the stock was blocked because there were already so many shorts in the market. It would have recognized that the analysts, all but two, threw up their hands. I do now want to turn to the damages issue Judge Willett mentioned, because that is an independent reason why this certification order should not stand. And that's reinforced by a decision just a couple weeks ago by the Fourth Circuit in Boeing. And all Dr. Feinstein does here is says, I'm going to use an out-of-pocket damages model. Well, that's not a model. That's a type of damages. As the Fourth Circuit says, that's no different than saying, I'm going to use compensatory damages. It doesn't create a model. And, the Fourth Circuit said, that would mean you're automatically invoking those words and you get to show that damages are a common issue. That would override the Supreme Court's Comcast decision. And Comcast is aimed at the problem when you have some damages attributable to the liability theory, which here was alleged fraudulent representations about the stock, but you have a lot of other price inflation attributable to other events. And so here that problem is magnified because even by their own account, their own expert says a lot of the stock movement was happening when there were no news events. So you have a real challenge in untangling any damages related to this news that they say involved misrepresentation versus damages that was random or driven by the meme stock dynamic.
Do you think the Boeing case reads Comcast a bit more demandingly than our own Ludlow decision does?
I don't, Your Honor. Ludlow, one of a small class, a month-long class in Ludlow, the court did say that damages model was sufficient and complied with Comcast. But even the district court in Ludlow rejected the model for the rest of the class, which had more of these complicated issues. So, you know, being able to come up with a model for a discrete one-month class period is quite different than doing it for this lengthy class period, where you have all these confounding factors driven by the social media activity, and where all he says is out of pocket. The only actual damages model he mentions is backcasting, and that's where you take the price decrease that happens when the news, the truth finally comes out in their view, and then you pull that out of the inflated stock price earlier on. But remarkably, that results in a negative price for about 6 months in 2021. It's an impossible number. So Dr. Feinstein tries to backtrack, and he said he doesn't disagree with that math. He doesn't disagree that his proposal would result in a negative stock price. What he says is, you know, I didn't commit to that model because he knows the math is bad now. But that creates a lose-lose proposition. Either he's using this model that is irrational because it results in a negative stock price, or he has no way at all to tease out what inflation is attributable to the supposed fraud. So either way, Comcast is not satisfied. Bottom line, Your Honors, this erratic stock movement untethered to news means both that the market was not efficient, and so individual issues of reliance would dominate, and independently, it means they have not come up with a damages model that can tease out price inflation attributable to their fraud theory. And so the individualized damages issues is a second reason why this court should reverse. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Costa, thank you. We'll see you back on rebuttal in about 20 minutes. So, Mr. Daly, welcome. Thank you. Whenever you're ready.
Let me try to move this lectern up a bit. No?
I don't think it's...
That's all right.
That's all right.
I'm a bit shorter than Mr. Costa.
Aren't we all?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Joseph Daly for the certified class of Cassava investors. This afternoon, I'm going to focus on three issues presented by the defendant's appeal. First, how recent events in the district court have mooted this interlocutory appeal. Second, that the district court, in its discretion and guided by case law and record evidence, correctly found the market for Cassava securities was an efficient one. And third, that Dr. Feinstein's damages methodology satisfied Comcast and this court's Ludlow precedent. Now, turning to the first issue, the recent binding settlement means that all four defendants will enjoy complete and final relief from this lawsuit, with all claims against them dismissed with prejudice. The timeline bears repeating. It was after this court granted defendants 23F petition complaining about market efficiency and damages that Cassava deliberately entered into a binding settlement of the action for $31.25 million, making sure to immunize both the company and the three executive defendants. I just heard Mr. Costa say that in the settlement papers, at a particular section, the appeal can go forward. That may be, but it doesn't say that the appeal can blow up the settlement. It's a binding settlement. If this court were to send this matter back down to the district court, the parties would move forward with the settlement procedures. There's no dispute that this settlement has been memorialized in three different media, two of which Cassava itself published, all right? The 8K filing with the SEC on December 19th, 2025, and then again in a press release a few days later. This settlement isn't a maybe or a perhaps. It's an existing binding resolution of this lawsuit, providing peace from further litigation for all four defendants.
Counsel, what happens to the settlement if we reverse, if we do get to the merits and we reverse? You say the settlement is binding. Mm-hmm. What would happen? Would you attempt a post-settlement certification?
Of course. And if there were to be, I mean, in these type of cases, there are sometimes in uncertified classes, there obviously has to be a certified class at the settlement stage. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the judge, in this case, Judge Ezra, would go through the 23A factors as well as the 23B3 factors. And I suggest if Judge Ezra were given guidance from this court on market efficiency and or damages, he would incorporate that into his final procedures. And I'm sure the experts would be fighting again over the proper way to look at both of those.
I guess the reason I ask is I'm not quite sure I understand why the issues here before us are moot. I'm not quite sure that that's the best way to describe them. Obviously, they're impactful, but you would have us just dismiss as being moot?
And if I said the issues were moot, I misspoke. I apologize. What I meant was the 23F petition itself has been mooted. This court, obviously, we would like the court to affirm Judge Ezra's class certification decision. But the court also has two more alternatives. It can either dismiss the appeal, which we would, of course, like, but it could also hold the results of the appeal in abeyance and allow Judge Ezra to go through those procedures. Remember, under Rule 23, a 23F petition, the grant does not stay the proceedings in the district court unless there's been a district court or court of appeals order. Judge Ezra, it's a little bit cryptic in his most recent order. He just says, I want to see what the Fifth Circuit tells me to do. He didn't say that my overseeing of this settlement depends upon the circuit court ruling upon market efficiency and damages. He just said, I want to see what the Fifth Circuit says. We suggest to you, Your Honors, respectfully, that you can tell Judge Ezra we're going to hold the result of this appeal, this interlocutory appeal, in abeyance and let you go forward with the procedures. I know the defendant said in the reply brief something about there could be a second appeal of this original class certification order following final approval. That is not going to happen. It's certainly not going to be them that are appealing that, right? They've agreed to the settlement. They've had to make concessions. Who would it be? Would it be objectors to the settlement? I've been doing this for 30 years. Objectors to the settlement come in and complain about two things, our attorney's fees, the plaintiff's class attorney's fees, and or the common fund, how it's distributed, whether the piece of the pie that they get. So nobody's coming in at final approval in front of Judge Ezra, which remains a live issue, and complaining about market efficiency and damages. But as I said, if this court felt that it had to give him guidance, it could. And I'm sure Dr. Stulls and Dr. Feinstein would then file their opposing briefs. So I want to turn now to the second issue, market efficiency, which was talked about at length while I was sitting there. The centerpiece of the anti-efficiency argument is the meme stock premise, but it's a false premise, all right? There is no record evidence, aside from some anecdotal chatter in some social media rooms, there's no record evidence that cassava stock was a meme stock. Defendant's expert, Dr. Stulls, admitted he had no evidence it was a meme stock. He admitted that even a meme stock, if it were true, could trade in an efficient market, and he admitted that he wasn't giving the opinion that cassava's market was an inefficient
market. But doesn't the record contain pretty substantial evidence that cuts against efficiency?
I don't think it cuts against efficiency. I think it raises interesting questions where the two opposing experts address those things. For example, Mr. Costa talked about, oh my God, the 49% turnover in cassava stock during 1 week. Well, that's less than one share of every outstanding share of cassava stock. The case that he was using to bolster that picture of doom and gloom is the Bradya case, where the stock turned over 1,400 times in a week. Every single share of that particular stock turned over at least once during a week.
But market efficiency is an element that you bear the burden to prove. They don't bear any burden to disprove it.
Of course.
But so if the record, well, it's a big if, you contest the if. If the record contains substantial evidence that cuts against efficiency, then how do you carry that burden if the district court never weighed any kind of contrary evidence?
Two answers. Number one, the record does not contain, what the record contains actually is 180 degrees away from that, all right? Dr. Feinstein submitted not one, not two, three event studies that tested for market efficiency, all right? And then he concluded that cassava stock reacted to new material information.
How does Feinstein's report show a non-speculative method of disaggregating the non-misrepresentation-related inflation?
He said that he would do another event study. He probably would be able to use some of the results of the first three that he's already done. He would use an event study, and he would also test, he would construct an inflation ribbon, which would have the inflation for every day of the stock period. But he would also be able to go in and look, using the events of, using the results of the event study, separate out, and he says this in his report, okay, he says it at pages 4276 through 4277 of the record, he would be able to isolate and exclude confounding information coming from the market as a whole or coming from the pharmaceutical industry as a discrete part. He already did that at the beginning of this entire process. He did it with three separate event studies using Cassava's 8K, using 8Ks, pardon me, 8Ks without earnings information, and the top 5% of the news days. Now, my friend makes it seem as though there was no news coming out about Cassava during this period, and what was happening on the interwebs, you know, in the social media, was driving the stock. Here's what was driving some of the stock movement. September 14th, the beginning of our class period, the defendants claim in an 8K that an outside lab has conducted a reanalysis of an earlier bad test for simufilam, right? The stock price climbs 133%. There's one example of volatility, all right? In July of 2021, just prior to the AI, I don't know the acronym, but it's the Alzheimer's conference, pardon me, Cassava comes out with an announcement. Here's what we're going to unveil at this conference in 5 days. It's cheerleading for simufilam. Cassava stock rises 30%.
And so do you dispute that there was also movement and volatility on no news days? I mean, I understand you're recounting what happened when news was disclosed, but what about the days where there was no news? Are you disputing what your friend
said? No, not at all, Your Honor. And what would happen would be Dr. Feinstein's methodology, which, by the way, there's a phrase in this court's Ludlow opinion. No matter what the Fourth Circuit says in Boeing with respect, this court has announced what the proper damages methodology is in these sort of cases. I believe it's at 685 of the Ludlow opinion. But Dr. Feinstein said he would account for those no news or low news days. We're not trying to gather in every single penny of inflation. It's a standard damages methodology. You X out the stuff. Maybe there's some good news in the pharmaceutical industry overall. Maybe there's some good news about Alzheimer's patients are actually living longer. That's a sort of news that can lift perhaps Cassava stock. But it's not related to the defendant's misstatements, is it? So that would be X'd out. In addition to those three event studies, Dr. Feinstein explained, and I believe Judge Douglas, you just touched upon this, that any volatility in cassava stock was rational, given that it had no product or earnings to speak of. All right, people were looking at the prospects of simufilam going forward. By the year 2033, if it were what they had said it was, it promised to be a $10 billion a year drug for this little company, all right? And disclosures about those prospects, both good and bad, right? The good news, drug efficacy, we've had a great phase 2B test now. We think we're ready for phase 3, which is large scale clinical trials. Good news like that, anticipated FDA approval, along with negative news, all right? Mr. Costa mentioned analysts getting fed up with Cassava. That's true. We started off with six analysts covering it during the class period. At least two and perhaps four dropped away. There were still two at the end of the class period. Criticism about the research, and then, of course, the news comes out, government investigations, the SEC is looking into Cassava and Schoen and Barbier. The Department of Justice has indicted Dr. Wang, which they point out the indictment was later dropped. We don't know why. It's not in the record. The point is that there was a lot of volatility in Cassava stock. It was of the firm's own making. It wasn't necessarily these external forces. Mr. Costa talked about, you know, the mentions on, I forget the Wall Street War Room or Twitter or Reddit. There were only five mentions in 1,400 articles during the class period about cassava, five mentions of the word meme associated with cassava. All right? It was not a meme sock. It didn't get 100 mentions. Pardon me, I misspoke. A true meme stock, like Rocket, had 100 times more mentions in these social media chat rooms than cassava. And just because some one or two isolated members of the class regarded it as a meme stock, that is of no moment, where we have here one expert, the plaintiff's expert, saying, no, it wasn't a meme stock. And you've got the other expert supposedly going at loggerheads with him, conceding, yes, I can't opine that it's a meme stock. You would think, with all of the anecdotal evidence we heard about 15 minutes ago, that Dr. Stolz would have put into his report, yes, I'm opining that this is definitely a meme stock, and that explains every facet of its movement. He didn't. So far as Judge Ezra applying an uncritical checklist, that's not what happened. We've briefed it at length. After he discarded the notion that A, cassava was a meme stock based upon the expert testimony I just mentioned, but also B, mentioning that this circuit has not yet opined on whether or not meme stocks can actually trade in an efficient market, he did what he was supposed to do. He turned immediately to the Kammer-Krogman factors, and he went through every one of them over 11 pages with copious citations to the record evidence, both Dr. Feinstein's reports and also Dr. Stolz's report. And it was at the end of that that he conceded, that he concluded that the market for cassava stock was an efficient one.
Now, those factors, you know, they're non-exhaustive, and the court must weigh evidence for and against efficiency. So what's your best defense of the district court's refusal to consider the volatility evidence, the short selling constraint, all that stuff?
But see, respectfully, Judge Willett, he didn't refuse to consider it, all right? He just said it didn't sway him. He explained how Dr. Feinstein had pointed out.
Well, he concluded the meme stock status was legally irrelevant under the factors.
Could you please repeat that? Did he?
No, he declined to weigh their efficiency evidence because he deemed the meme stock status. He said meme stock status is legally irrelevant.
I'm going to put a finer point on that. I'm not sure if he used the word irrelevant. I think he said, nobody has told me, there's no binding authority out there telling me that I cannot find that a meme stock was trading in an efficient market. And then when he turned to the Kammer factors, he went through each one of them, and he cited to Dr. Feinstein's report when he accepted Dr. Feinstein's opinion that there were no constraints upon short selling in this particular stock, for example. So he did address some of those more troubling aspects. Obviously, he addressed the volatility, but as Dr. Feinstein explained, there's a good reason for that, given the size of this company and the great promise. Turning quickly, please, to the damages. Plaintiff's experts' damages model satisfied both Comcast and Ludlow. Again, with respect, I know we here on the plaintiff's side, whatever Boeing said about the damages methodology in that case, it doesn't control here. This court in Ludlow noted approvingly that expert was using, and I'm quoting, the out-of-pocket damages methodology, end quote. That's the very same phrase that Boeing hates and tossed out the window. But when this court said that, it also noted several truisms. Comcast does not require certainty, but only a sound methodology, all right? The corrective disclosure methodology being used in Ludlow was a methodology, quote, often used in these type of cases, end quote. And the damages theory was consistent with plaintiff's liability theory that BP's misstatements inflated the stock, which was later relieved by corrective events. And critically, that methodology allowed for the removal of corrective events, what I've been referring to as confounding events, that didn't actually correct the misrepresentations. Well, Dr. Feinstein did the same thing here. He laid out the plaintiff's theory of liability, that misstatements artificially inflated cassava stock and call options and depressed put options. And that is in the record at page 4272, paragraph 272. He then opined that the out-of-pocket damage methodology, quote, measures specifically this loss, end quote, caused by the introduction and dissipation of inflation. That's in the record at page 4273, paragraph 273. And then, and this is critical, and this was in our 28J response letter, he explained at length the methodology that he would use, and that is in the record at page 5818 through 5822. He's going to use event studies. Remember, he already did three exhaustive event studies using three different baskets of information compared to not one but two variables, the market as a whole and the pharmaceutical industry sector. All right, he would use event studies. He would construct an inflation ribbon for cassava stock. For the options, he would use one of the two well-accepted, peer-reviewed, been in law review articles for 30 years, methods of pricing options, the American binomial method or Black-Scholes. He would put a limitation on damages using the PSLRA's 90-day look-back period. And he would isolate and exclude what he called confounding information that caused non-fraud-related losses. And that particular promise is at page 4276 through 4277 of the record. And, of course, he cautioned, as he should have. He had not yet done a loss causation analysis, which the Supreme Court says we don't do at this stage, and he had not actually computed damages, as that requires a fully developed record. After discovery, this will all come together, and he will be able to construct an airtight damages model for this particular case. So winding down now, Your Honors, I would just say that given the extensive record here, complemented by precedent and an extensive record, we ask this court to do one of three things. Number one, obviously, we would hope that it would dismiss the appeal. Number two, we would ask that you uphold the district court's discretionary class certification decision. Or number three, at the very least, we would ask that you hold the appeals result in abeyance and allow Judge Ezra to go forward with the preliminary and final approval.
Okay, Mr. Daly, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Costa, you've got a whopping 4 minutes.
All right, I'll start with damages. I heard opposing counsel say the expert will account for, the Comcast requirement that he would isolate confounding factors. There's no description of how he would do it. I heard that he would do an event study. Same thing in Boeing. Those are just words. What Ludlow says is you don't need to put the numbers into the model. You don't need to spit out the math. But you do need to show a model that has the ability, that's the key word, the ability to isolate damages or injury attributable to your liability theory versus all the other confounding factors that are all over the place in this case. They just haven't done that, and that means there's really no way to test whether it would be able to disaggregate the confounding factors. And Goldman Sachs says that has to happen at the certification stage. I want to turn to efficiency, and I just want to put to rest, first of all, Stoltz, as I acknowledge, he would not say it was a meme stock one way or the other. It's not true that he denied it was a meme stock. It's also not true, as the district court said, that he said there was no evidence of it being a meme stock. That just appears nowhere in his report or in his deposition. And again, his report is filled with all these dynamics of inefficiency, which is what the factors look to, right? The factors are not a checklist. They're a tool to get to the ultimate issue of efficiency. And here, as I've recounted, as the brief recounts, there's an extreme news price disconnect. There's irrational volume untethered to news. There's the short selling constraint, which I didn't hear much about. That's undisputed. Their expert does not dispute that there was a short selling constraint. What he tries to say, and you heard some of that just now, is, well, there were an options was another vehicle for allowing negative news to be reflected in the stock price. But that's factually wrong and economically wrong. Factually, there was not a robust options market. On half of days, there was no options trading in cassava stock, and the borrowing rates to do so were extraordinary. Economically, it doesn't help because an option is basically a side bet. that doesn't involve in and of itself the purchase of a stock. But what will often happen is the market maker taking that options bet will then go hedge in the market by shorting the stock. So that's why sometimes options can get over the problem of a short selling constraint. But here you end up right back with the fact that short selling was blocked because there were already so many shorts in the market. The district court and Dr. Feinstein did not recognize that the options issue gets you right back to this short selling constraint that really is critical because that explains why wasn't the news being reflected in the stock price. It's because of the short selling constraints. That pipeline was clogged. And then I want to end with this mootness issue. You know, they're putting the cart before the horse. Any settlement of a class depends on a properly certified class. That's Rule 23. That's AmChem. The settlement agreement itself recognizes that. And notably, the settlement agreement, footnote 7, it doesn't propose a different, separate, narrower settlement class. It says this class is certifiable because of it's already been certified by Judge Ezra. It hinged entirely on the order that this court is reviewing. I also don't understand how the two defendants who didn't sign any settlement would ever be precluded from appealing. And there are cases we cite, and including the Deepwater Horizon decision from this court, that show you can have an appeal even after a class settlement. And here, those objectors are likely to be out there because of the parallel copycat case where those people have already indicated they're going to object to this settlement. So as Judge Ezra recognized, the efficient course would be to decide these certification questions now before the cumbersome and expensive class settlement process gets started. For those reasons, we would ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Costa, thank you. Thanks to both sides for the helpful briefing and advocacy today. We appreciate it, and the case is submitted.